rise.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Frisch, Judge Gaetis, the Honorable Renee Werke presiding.
Good morning. Go ahead and take a seat. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have three matters that are set for oral argument calendar today, January 25, 2024. Housekeeping, just want to remind you, you each have 15 minutes. 5 minutes is reserved to appellant counsel for rebuttal if you choose to utilize that. The podium does have a switch that you can adjust it up or down for your comfort as far as your argument is concerned. And lastly, please remember to indicate your name and the party you're speaking on behalf of for our record purposes. Appellate counsel, I need to have our marshal call the first case for hearing.
Calling case number 823-0658, State versus Farrell.
Now I can say appellant counsel when you're ready. Proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. Good morning, counsel. My name is Nicole Cornell. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota, who is the appellant in this matter. In this case, respondent strangled his former romantic partner several times during a domestic incident. Though he was charged with two felonies, he did a straight plea to third degree assault, and the state dismissed the other felony, which was domestic assault by strangulation. The agreement was a straight plea, and respondent would be free to move the district court for his preferred disposition, which was a downward durational departure for a gross misdemeanor sentence in this case. The district court imposed a guideline sentence, which was a stay of imposition. No actual jail time served, just EHM for 60 days. Immediately after the sentence was pronounced on the record, respondent requested to withdraw his guilty plea. The district court granted that request from the bench without citing the applicable legal standards, without assessing respondent's reasons for withdrawal, and without finding facts regarding the validity of respondent's guilty plea. Failure to do those three things I just listed was an abuse of discretion in this case. The state is asking this court to reverse the district court's decision, allowing respondent to withdraw his guilty plea after sentencing.
I'll defer to you.
Thank you. Given the allegation that was made by defense counsel, which seems to be that the district court judge improperly participated in the plea negotiations, was this judge the right individual to even be hearing this motion?
I think that's a good question. I think what normally happens in this type of plea withdrawal case is that either the plea withdrawal motion is made, you know, on the record right at sentencing, but the best practice would be to file a post-conviction petition where perhaps the judge could decide to recuse or the petitioner could elect to file for recusal and get a different judge. The typical best practice, I think, would be the latter. However, in this case, I think...
But then here, this is my question, which is akin to that. So if we agree with you and we think it was an abuse of discretion and we reverse... sentenced, I mean, what happens?
Sure. I would point your honors to the footnote in Wheeler, which is footnote 8. And then in Wheeler, if your honors recall, it was a Hennepin County District Court case. That particular trial judge who was later sort of, I hate to say the word accused, but it was brought up that there was some excessive involvement or participation, improper participation in the plea negotiations.
Alleged sounds better than accused.
Alleged, exact, thank you. And so that district court judge who presided over the trial also presided over the post-conviction petition, and the Minnesota Supreme Court wrote in its footnote that when it remanded the matter, it suggested that the judge could herself recuse, that the parties could make a filing to remove the judge and get a different judge. It essentially, that court left it up to the parties on remand and including the judge to figure out what was the best in that scenario. I don't represent respondent in this matter. I don't know what respondent's interest would be in having the same judge preside or a different judge preside. I think there's some interest at stake there, and it's sort of not up to me to sort of put that position out there. But the interesting part about this case is that there are very few people who were present in that in-chambers discussion who could sort of illuminate what happened there, what the context was of those statements. And it's the district court judge in this case, defense counsel, but the prosecutor is no longer with the office and is actually out of state, I believe. And so if this court were to remand with specific instructions, like Judge Moreno should keep this case or a different judge should take this case, I just don't know what your honors are thinking in terms of that. But, you know, if this particular district court judge is one of the only two people left in the state to know.
Is there any authority for this court telling the trial court who gets to hear the case and who doesn't?
I think I've seen that type of remand instruction in the context of a Schwartz hearing, perhaps, where there may have been sort of judicial influence in that case. So I think I have seen instructions like that before where this court would say, you know, the same district court judge should not preside. I haven't seen an instruction instructing a particular district court judge to retain the case, if that was your question.
So what's your position as to what should happen if this case were remanded? It sounds like you're requesting that the judge assignment be left up to the judge and the parties. Mm-hmm. But what do you think should happen in front of whatever judge ultimately ends up with the case? Should the plea and sentence simply be reinstated? Or would you agree that the respondent here is entitled to a new hearing on the motion to withdraw?
I have been contemplating that very question. And the state's first position is what it included in its brief, and that, you know, if the roles were reversed, typically this court would just reverse and not necessarily remand for any particular proceedings. It would just reverse the order. There's nothing in the record. That was, you know, the defendant's bite at the apple that they got. They didn't make the appropriate record for the district court to lawfully allow plea withdrawal, and so it should just be sort of a rewind and stop when you get to that plea withdrawal motion in the record. So that's the state's first position, is just reverse. Because based on this record, the defendant had an opportunity to make an appropriate record for plea withdrawal and did not. It was an inadequate record.
Well, I'll push back on that a little bit because, you know, based on my reading of that transcript, the judge got involved pretty quickly in sort of participating in the evidentiary record that was made. What could defense counsel have done to improve the record that was being made given the judge's involvement?
I guess I'm not sure what you mean by evidentiary record.
Yeah, well, the judge in addressing the motion gave what I would characterize, and I certainly can't speak for anyone else on this panel, as sort of testimony, you know, about what had happened, about the judge's perception of the events underlying the motion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so given that situation, what could defense counsel have done? And this, of course, is a question I'm asking in connection with your sort of remedy one. What could defense counsel have done to preserve or meet his burden?
I think that's a great question. And the first answer I have for Your Honor is that in this case, immediately after the sentence was pronounced, the parties approached the bench. We don't know what was said during that bench conference, but when the parties went back and it was the defense counsel's turn to speak, the only words out of his mouth were, "We request to withdraw the plea." There was no basis. There was no standard there. There was no reasonings presented at all. And then the district court asked the state to respond. And the state's response was, "There's no record here. We haven't talked about anything." So then it was defense counsel got sort of a second bite at the apple to make an evidentiary record, which is what is required. There needs to be some reasoning on the record for the district court to analyze. And the reasons there are, as I laid out in my brief, The reasons were defendant was prepared to go to trial. The court asked to see the parties in chambers, and I think that's an unclear record. We don't know who asked to go see the chambers, if the judge, you know, sua sponte said, come on in, everybody. We don't know that. That's another drawback to the record here. The third reason, I think there was some discussions back there about a plea of guilty, that there could be some sort of departure. Could be some sort of departure are the key words there. And then defense counsel said, we took it, and I advise my client that would be done. And finally, Wheeler states that that's not right. So that was the record that was made. And the second caveat I would like to point out is this reason four. We took it, and I advised my client that that would be done. Looking at this record, I don't see how one could go from ground four. I think there was some discussions back there about a plea of guilty could be done, and then somehow interpreting that and talking to his client saying, I advise my client that that would be done. And so if I'm putting myself in the district court shoes there, I'm not sure if what this particular defendant is alleging is a Wheeler violation or something akin to a Kaiser violation. I cite State versus Kaiser in my brief. And in Kaiser, the issue there was whether there was coercion by defense counsel. And so I think the record is,
why
unclear.
Why isn't it just a misunderstanding by the defendant based on the communications that, I mean, this, it strikes me that this may be an ineffective assistance of counsel issue, but still rendering his plea invalid because he believed, based on his consultation with counsel, that he was going to get a departure.
And, Your Honor, I would just push back on that. I don't know if there is a record that shows at present that the defendant truly believed.
So that goes to, I think, Judge Gaitis's point.
Sure.
Indicates, I think, some heavy-handedness by the district court. Very pointed, directed questions to the defendant. You don't think that happened, do you? And then what is the defendant supposed to say given that position in district court? I mean, I don't know where the room is for a record to be made that, given this proceeding, that the defendant really believed something that believe that something was going to happen that actually didn't happen.
And, Your Honor, my only pushback is that the belief, it's unclear from the record that that belief would have stemmed from the in-chambers discussion. I think the belief likely more stems from whatever the defense counsel sort of interpreted from that in-chambers discussion and then said to his client. So I think sort of the impetus or the maybe illicit promise is not the right word, but the confusion there was some confusion that occurred between the chambers conference and when the defense counsel talked to his client.
And why do we need to pinpoint exactly the exact source of that confusion? I mean, something mm-hmm. happened there. Mm-hmm. The defendant was laboring under a misconception as to what was going to happen at the sentencing hearing based on his straight plea. And then when it didn't turn out to be the way that he wanted, they wanted to withdraw the plea. I mean, I'm missing that connection there.
And I don't think this court or the district court even needed to do that in this case, needed to pinpoint exactly where the sort of the involuntariness stemmed from. But I think what's important to point out here is that that was confusing. That is the record that the defense counsel made in the case, and that record was insufficient for the district court to rule on the motion in the way that it did.
Well, the district court also did make a very good record. Would you agree? I mean, we don't have factual findings from the district court, and as you point out in your brief, we don't have the judge applying the law to the facts, and both of those things are really necessary for this court to review what happened. Wouldn't you agree?
I agree. I think the record is slim, fine, scarce, those types of words, but what is important to point out here is that the district court should have done the sort of Wheeler two-step analysis. So it was essentially two steps that the district court did not do. And in part, perhaps because, you know, the evidentiary record, as Your Honor has called it, was not enough for the district court to even do the analysis. That's why we're asking for a straight reversal. But if this court does remand with the opportunity for a hearing, you know, however broad in scope, the district court does have to do two particular analyses here. The first step is, did the defendant demonstrate improper judicial participation in the plea bargaining negotiation itself under Johnson and Wheeler? The answer to that, you know, is what the district court will determine, and whoever that district court judge may be. The second step is necessary because just if there is improper judicial participation in the plea negotiation process does not require immediate reversal. You still have to do the second step, which is the totality of the circumstances analysis into whether the plea was involuntary and therefore invalid, creating a manifest injustice. So it's actually a two-step analysis that the district court did not do at first glance, and now on remand it would have the opportunity to do that. And I agree with Your Honors. Factual findings are required. The Wheeler analysis is a legal analysis, essentially, but you must base that legal analysis on some type of factual finding. So I think there's factual findings required for both. And so I did want to clarify that it's a very specific two-step analysis that was missing below that resulted in an abuse of discretion, and with this court's remand, it should conduct the two-part analysis there. I have about 25 seconds remaining, but I am happy to answer questions on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Drake Metzger, and I represent the respondent, Mr. Spencer Farrell, in his pretrial appeal. This court should affirm the district court order granting Mr. Farrell's motion to withdraw his plea because it was not a valid plea. I believe withdrawal was necessary to correct a manifest injustice.
Didn't the judge have to make findings or at least do something for us to determine whether it was appropriate?
I'm going to concede there are terrible findings of fact in this case. Yeah, there are none.
I think you're in a better position to urge us to reverse and remand instead of a direct reversal.
Well, I do think that that at best remanding to district court for an evidentiary hearing is, I think, the best case scenario for the state. I think under the circumstances here, though, in the transcript we have, I do think this court can still find that there was a manifest injustice. Because the court, I believe, on this record, did inappropriately get into the plea negotiation process.
Does that mean that the evidentiary hearing, what does it look like? What does that evidentiary hearing look like for you? I'm sorry, for your client.
I would defer to trial counsel. But I imagine that there would need to be testimony from, at the very least, his district court counsel, Mr. Goldfein, potentially finding Mr. Lynn to come in and testify, and potentially even Judge Moreno. I think that's very possible that might need to be. And I'm not going to tell the trial court counsel how to do their job, but I think those are all potential witnesses at an evidentiary hearing regarding specifically a Wheeler violation. But that said, under the transcript that we have here, I think this court can still find that the court did inappropriately get into the plea negotiation. If you look at the way this played out, the offer is put on the record on the day of trial. Then at some point, the court calls the parties back into chambers for a chambers conference. There's no evidence either the parties requested that chambers conference, and there's no evidence that the parties were requesting sentencing information, sentencing practices, things like that. They come out of that chambers conference, they come back from lunch. Now Mr. Farrell is ready to do a straight plea. And I think it's notable that the offer that was on the record was actually better than what the sentence ended up being. So, this is not a situation where Mr. Farr was like, okay, I'm gonna take this because, I'm gambling here. This might be worse. Like, if he was under the impression that he was going to get something better because of that chambers conference from the court under a straight plea, that, in my opinion, is the only reason you would do a straight plea versus accept the state's offer that was on the record. So I do think that this court can find that the court did get into the settlement negotiations. Now, I don't, Your Honor did point out, what is Mr. Goldfein supposed to do in the situation when they go to withdraw his plea? He's sitting here facing a judge, put in the position of saying, Judge, you're lying, you promised him this. And, that's certainly a predicament for any trial court attorney. But even on the record here, the Judge Murillo immediately presses him. Are you saying I promised him anything? No, I'm not saying that. But he clarifies at the end of that transcript, so you're just saying I encourage your client to take a plea. I think even that is still inappropriate getting into the plea negotiation from the court.
Can we infer from the fact that he quickly granted the motion without making any factual findings that he agreed with defense counsel, that there was inappropriate entanglement in negotiations?
I think that can be inferred from the circumstances. You know, again, the district court judge was there in the chamber's conference. He says he doesn't think that the recitation of the facts is exactly what happened, but he doesn't make any findings as to what actually happened.
He doesn't say, no, I didn't encourage you to plead guilty.
I agree. He doesn't deny that necessarily. He just says, I don't think that's my recollection is different than yours, basically. But he doesn't specify what actually happened, doesn't make any findings that that argue against a Wheeler violation. But I do think the fact that he granted the motion is telling, because I think the judge recognized, hey, maybe I did inappropriately entangle myself in these plea negotiations. So if he wants his trial, I'm happy to give it to him.
If a judge fails to perform any legal analysis in granting a motion, is that sufficient for this court to conclude there was an abuse of discretion?
I don't think we're under an abuse of discretion standard on this case. I believe this is a de novo review. I think under the fair and just standard, that is a discretionary part of a subdivision of the plea withdrawal. But under the manifest injustice, whether or not a manifest injustice has occurred is a de novo review for this court.
We're just looking at the validity of the plea, whether it was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary.
That's my position, yes. And I think under these facts, I believe there's a blatant Wheeler violation. I think the fact that defense counsel invoked Wheeler right away flagged to the court that this is a, judge, you inappropriately got into this, and this is not fair. We went back into chambers. There was talk of a departure. I came out, told my client that's what's going to happen. And I think there's a potential ineffective issue, too, going on here. But ultimately, I guess big picture, where does this go? Let's say you grant the state reversal. Okay, we reinstate the sentence. He's put on probation. He still has a post-conviction remedy under an ineffective. So we're still going to be back. We're still going to have an evidentiary hearing, and I imagine all this is going to be relitigated again. I think it makes the most sense for this court to just affirm the order and just acknowledge that, you know, on this record, I believe that there's still a manifest injustice that needs to be corrected as evidenced by the record before this court.
What about the argument that we don't know what's happening here, whether we're in the Wheeler universe or the Kaiser universe? So how can we, with any certainty, go along with your position if we don't even really know what the sort of basis was for the grant of the motion?
Well, I think we're because defense counsel invoked Wheeler, I think we know we're in a Wheeler scenario. And the fact that the court does not make any effort to say that didn't happen, I didn't promise anything, I didn't get involved, I think is also telling under the context that he immediately granted the motion. Additionally, this court could find on this record as well that this is ineffective. Counsel has said, we went into chambers, there was talk of a departure. That's what I told my client's going to happen. So I think this court could find that not only was it involuntary, but it was also unintelligent because he's advised by defense counsel, as he's admitted, that he's going to get a departure at sentencing. And so I think under either of those, this court can find that a manifest injustice occurred and it needs to be corrected by a plea by allowing Mr. Farrell to withdraw his plea. Again, I would just reiterate, I think the court, the three areas under Wheeler that a judge does not violate this by, I guess, getting or questioning or being involved in the plea negotiations, none of those exist here. I think the judge has inappropriately gotten into the plea negotiations here. I think that's clear from the record. That's clear from the fact that defense counsel immediately invokes Wheeler and that there's really no findings of fact to dispute that. I do think the representations made by defense counsel do support that Wheeler violation, and I would ask this court to affirm that order. Yeah, I think it's a relatively straightforward issue for the court. Unless there's any additional questions, I'm happy to yield the rest of my time here.
Thank you, Ms. Murray. Right,
thank you.
And Ms. Cornell, you have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have one minor point to make, unless the court has questions.
I have a question.
Yes.
We've talked a lot about the district court's questioning after the defendant set forth the basis for the plea withdrawal. But the state didn't say anything after the reasons were placed on the record. What do we make of that?
Your Honor, I don't know what can be made of that, simply because the number of transcript pages that we are scrutinizing here is two. It's pages 11 through 12, I believe.
Right.
That's it. Things were moving very quickly. I don't know if there was an opportunity to interject before the district court said, okay, let's set a trial date.
Well, Mr. Lutz did argue that no record had been made in support of the motion, and then the record had been made, and then there was nothing further from the state after the record had been made.
And, Your Honor, I think that Your Honor's initial question is, what can we make of that? I don't think we can make anything of that, considering how quickly things unfolded. But one clarification, yes, reviewing the validity of a plea is de novo, but what this court is looking at is, was there an abuse of discretion in granting the motion? So we are in abuse of discretion land here. I think respondent's main argument is that there was a plain Wheeler-Johnson violation in this case, and I want to be clear. The only Wheeler allegation made below that is in as a Wheeler violation, it certainly wasn't explicit, and it wasn't tied to the involuntary nature of the plea, but it is the statement encouraging respondent or defendant to plead guilty in this case. And I just want to point out that encouraging a defendant to plead guilty is not addressed by Johnson. It's not addressed by Wheeler. In fact, in Wheeler footnote 5, the Supreme Court says we're not reaching that part of the analysis because it was reversing on other grounds. But it's that issue was not reached by Johnson or Wheeler or any other case that I have come across post-Wheeler. And again, in this case, the record does not indicate what encouraging meant. What
encouraging could be really bad, though, right? I mean, would you agree with that?
You know, it's a spectrum. I don't know what anyone meant by the word encouraging. I truly don't know. And I don't think it's inferable from the record what encouragement meant. And I think in general, there are always encouragements from various people, places, and things for a defendant to plead guilty.
It's a little different when it comes from the presiding judge, though, don't you
think?
No
doubt, no doubt. And I think that's why it's a cautionary practice. I hate to say practice. I don't know what the appropriate word there would be. But I do think it's important to note that encouragement means different things to different people. The encouragement present in Wheeler was, think about your kids. Think about your kids testifying here. That is entirely different in kind to saying something that likely happened in this case is saying to the parties, are you going to resolve this case? What's the holdup here? Sort of inquiring as to the status of the negotiations is how I read that.
Ms. Cornell, I think you noted during your principal argument that it would be very difficult to recreate what even happened here, given the passage of time and change in circumstances. And I think you mentioned the prosecutor's not even available anymore. Doesn't that support Mr. Metzger's argument that perhaps we should just infer what we can infer and you lose?
I disagree, and I disagree because we're in a two-step analysis here. Let's assume a Wheeler violation happened. Before you can even assume a Wheeler violation happened, you have to assume that encouragement in this context was a Wheeler violation. But then the second step, you still have to look at the totality of the circumstances here. You have to weigh that allegation against the entire record, which appellant lays out in page 16 of its principal brief. All the different times this defendant said, I am not coerced, no one's promising me anything. I know I have to prove that I'm eligible and entitled for a downward durational departure in this case. All of those comments, no promises, no threats, no coercion to plead guilty, and you have to weigh that in the totality of the circumstances. And what I want to point out here is even that initial presumption, even if you assume, if a factual record is unidentifiable on remand what actually happened there, even if you have to just assume that the statement was made, that the district court encouraged the parties to come to some sort of plea agreement, then again, the district court has to look at Johnson and Wheeler and determine, so I'm assuming encouragement took place. Is that a Wheeler violation? I still don't think there's enough legal authority to make that conclusion. I see I'm out of time. Appellant requests that this court reverse. Thank you.
Thank you. The arguments are helpful. The matter is submitted, and a decision will be issued in the 90-day time frame. Thank you.